This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're following news about retired Red Sox slugger David Ortiz, who was shot in his native Dominican Republic last night. At last report, he's in stable condition, but part of his colon has been removed. Ortiz also suffered injuries to his gallbladder and liver. The Sox will hold a news conference later this hour. We'll bring you updates as they come in. While we're waiting, we turn to our conversation with presidential candidate and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's campaigning in New Hampshire today, and we reached her shortly after an appearance at a Politics and Eggs breakfast at St. Anselm College. Klobuchar was speaking before business and political leaders there and laid out what she calls a progressive yet common sense agenda addressing health care, immigration, and the need for better infrastructure in states like New Hampshire.
We have to be able to respond to what we need. And what you need here, just like actually in my state, you need more workers to be able to come up and fill the jobs. You need to make it easier for people to come back and forth. You've got a great tourism industry here that could be even greater.
Senator, I was watching your appearance at Politics and Eggs this morning and was struck by something you said about infrastructure spending and the 2017 Trump tax cuts. You voted against that tax cut bill, but suggested this morning that you might have been able to vote yes if the corporate tax rate had not been lowered so significantly and if the bill had included infrastructure spending. So can you fill in some more details? I mean, what's a compromise that could have gotten you to support the tax cuts?
That bill was way off in so many ways, and I was just pointing out that the president lost an opportunity to actually get a bill passed that would have worked. And that could have involved some lowering of the corporate tax rate. I've made that clear for years that they could have been part of it. But he went way too far with that. The way they did the international tax return was totally off. We actually could get back $150 billion just by changing that. There were significant problems with the bill, with the way they structured a co-op provision. There were so many things wrong with the bill that you would want to start over. And that doesn't mean that there weren't some things you would include from that bill.
So for you to get to yes, it would have taken a lot to get you to yes.
Yes, that's what I want to make clear. However, I think it was widely believed, and I certainly believe this, that that is your opportunity, and there will be another one, to use a tax bill, to use that tax bill and the way some of the money was wasted to help finance infrastructure, because the corporate tax rate should not have gone that low to 21%. I think most companies, even those that were involved in lobbying on this, seemed to think at some point it was going to be around 25-26%, and it went all the way down to 21%, and every point was $100 billion that could have been spent on transit in Massachusetts or a new community rail system in New Hampshire, or roads and bridges, or rural broadband. And that just didn't happen.
Are Democrats, though, missing an opportunity on infrastructure as well, Senator? I'm thinking of a recent White House meeting between Trump and Democratic leaders that was going to focus on infrastructure. But as you recall, that sort of blew up very quickly after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the president was guilty of a cover-up. I mean, is that kind of rhetoric that maybe, you know, stops Democrats from getting things done on infrastructure, too?
Well, I think we know there's all kinds of things going on in Washington right now. I looked at that meeting this way. On Donald Trump's election night, one of the top things he said he wanted to get done was infrastructure. And he has done absolutely nothing. We've been basically living off the FAST Act, which was a bill that was helpful, that passed, that I supported, that passed before he got there. And now nothing has happened. And for him to have called that meeting, and then when they said, okay, Mr. President, come back with some ideas and ways to finance it, like I've done with my trillion-dollar plan, by the way, I've been very clear, laid out every single penny and how it's going to work. And then when he came back, it turns out they already had that plan. We know that. The media knew it, where he was just going to basically walk out of there and say, oh, I don't like you guys because you're investigating me. Come on. To me, it was because he didn't want to move forward. He didn't have a way to pay for it except to take some of the money out of his tax bill that was so tilted toward the wealthy, and it's so obvious how we should pay for this, but he didn't want to do that, so then he storms out and tries to make a scene. So, I mean, that is just typical. It's what he did this last week on the tariffs, where he sort of sets up a mock situation and says, oh, I'm going to put this 5% tariff because I'm mad about immigration.
On Mexico.
And then right, on exports. And then he comes around and says, no, 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 I've saved the day with a plan that we've later found out was already a plan before he did that. And I just think this makes a mockery of our politics and our government at a time when people are looking for trust and stability. They want to have a leader in the White House that says, you know, yeah, we have immigration issues at the border, but we also have immigration issues for our country. We don't have enough workers in some of our factories and our farmers. We want to have new ideas and new businesses. We should have comprehensive immigration reform. It reduces the debt by $158 billion in 10 years. That was the 2013 bill. And he could have done that. He could have been Nixon going to China when he first got elected. But he didn't do that. And so all of these issues that are right on our table right now, things like climate change and workforce training and immigration reform and doing something about our healthcare system and pharmaceutical prices, those are challenges that are hitting people right now in front of him. And instead, he chooses to basically rest on the laurels of this economy that has been stabilized by the good work of our businesses and our workers instead of meeting the challenges in front of him. He loves chaos. He uses it to foment discord and to help him with his base. It is really obvious, and that's why we need a leader, and this is the leader that I can be and will be, who's going to look at governing in a very different way. That is how you bring people together.
Let me ask you about some big recent news in the state where you're campaigning right now. So New Hampshire last month became the 21st state to abolish the death penalty. Minnesota did this way back in 1911, so catching up to Minnesota about a century later. You didn't have death penalty cases then when you were a county prosecutor. So let me ask you if New Hampshire made the right move in your view.
Yes, I am opposed to the death penalty. I look at it this way. First of all, as a former prosecutor, I always look at what helps reduce crime. But when you look at the states that have it, they don't have lower crime rates. In some cases, they have higher crime rates. I also look at money fiscally. It is very expensive. It is actually more expensive because of the appeals than having life without parole. And we have life without parole for very dangerous criminals, for very dangerous murders. The last thing I look at is how it has been racially discriminatory, that it has not been fairly used across the country. In any case, I do not support the death penalty. And I had this position when I was county attorney, and I have it today.
So one of your highest profile cases when you were a county attorney was against the Baseball Hall of Famer Kirby Puckett. I want to ask you about—
people don't always bring up that, especially when the Twins are having like the best season in over a decade. I just had to bring that in there for Red Sox fans.
Yeah, go Twins. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're sort of on the bubble here in Boston in the meantime.
I know. You've had some, let's just say you've had some good teams.
Yeah, hard to complain. And our Bees, maybe we'll bring home another one.
Yeah, okay. But the Twins are owed this, man. They're the Cinderella team.
Let me ask you about this case, though.
Let's go serious.
Yeah, well, so you just for folks who don't remember, you charged him in 2002 with sexual assault for allegedly groping a woman in a bar. He was later acquitted. You wrote in your 2015 memoir that our prosecutors believed her account of what happened, the woman who had accused him. Do you still believe Puckett's accuser? And were you ahead of the Me Too movement when you decided to bring those charges?
Well, we have a job. When I was the chief prosecutor, our job was to evaluate the facts and the evidence and make a decision. And we had actually had some cases brought in that we hadn't charged with him that were not about bars or about that. It was other things involving his ex-wife. And we didn't think the case was there. But in this point, we did feel it was there. We knew it was going to be a very hard case because we only had one witness. And we charged it as a lower level offense, as it should have been. And what happened was it went to jury. We had a very experienced prosecutor on it. I think people felt that we did a really good job with the case. And we looked at this and we thought, look, if this wasn't against a famous person, I actually had them show me. I had our prosecutors show me cases that we had brought in similar circumstances. So we decided to charge it, knowing it was going to be a hard go. Beloved figure in Minnesota. I still remember the words that I said when we charged it. Like, for every Minnesotan, Kirby Puckett was my hero, but that day, that night in that bar, he was no one's hero, which was a true fact.
So was justice served, though, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
By bringing the case, yes, we did the right thing. We didn't win. I remember one of our claims to fame was that the jury was out longer than like OJ's and three other sports stars combined. And so I felt like justice was done because we did the right thing in bringing the case. The jury made their decision, but it was still the right thing to do. And the victim felt that way even after we lost, and we felt that way. And I think the community felt that way. And sometimes you just have to make hard decisions, even if they don't seem popular at the time.
So we've seen some voters give you credit for that case, for being willing to charge a powerful man with sexual assault. But as you know, the other side of your reputation as a tough prosecutor is some criticism for charging smaller offenses. You said when you were running in 1998, for example, that the broken windows theory is correct. And that was a theory popularized by Rudy Giuliani that cracking down on petty crime can curb serious crime. What's your current position on the broken windows theory?
Well, obviously, there have been abuses of that. I just want to make clear, we only had felony adult crimes, so we didn't have some of those crimes that were being prosecuted in New York in my jurisdiction. We did in the juvenile area, but in Minnesota, the juvenile system is, with the exception of serious crime, tends to give kids a second chance. So what I've learned over time is a much bigger emphasis I took as I went through my 8 years in that job on drug court, on trying to get people off of drugs, off of alcohol, that is a major contributing force when we look at our some of our petty crimes as well as our more serious crimes. And I'm a big believer in those. I led the effort in the Senate. The other thing I learned, that anyone that is being honest that has a prosecutor job will tell you, that there's racism in our system. And that while my state tends to have lower sentences for most crimes, like every other state, there were things that were not fair racially. So what are the answers there? Well, I worked hard to make our office and who we hired more reflective of the community, including people in leadership positions in my office and our management team. I worked hard to make sure that the way we had cases brought in was fair. I did this innovative work with the Innocence Project, doing eyewitness identifications a different way that would reduce racial misidentification, as well as we had videotaped interrogations. We were one of the first states that did that. And then the way we select grand juries. I mean, there's just so many things. And then, of course, sentencing. And that I've had a bigger opportunity to be involved in as a senator with the First Step Act, which I'm so glad that we finally got done on a bipartisan basis, which reduces federal drug sentences for people that are nonviolent offenders. They were pretty out of control at the high end, a lot of them. Stories like Josephina, this woman that Barack Obama ended up pardoning, that served over a decade in prison when, in fact, she wasn't even someone who was doing drugs or actually selling them. She was a middle person for someone else. And so anyway, I'm glad about that. And if I could just move forward of what we have to do. Body cameras, good idea.
Oh, and we're just rolling those out in Boston now, too. So it's very,
right, exactly.
Yeah, very top of mind.
And then the one other thing I would add is the Second Step Act, which will be creating incentives for states to do the same thing we did federally.
So you've been very busy on this front, but I guess I want to give you a chance to respond to some criticism that I know you have heard as well, which is that, you know, and granted, you inherited these racial disparities when you were a county attorney, but Nakima Levy-Armstrong, who's the former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP, recently told the Washington Post, talking about your tenure, she said, rather than taking steps to help mitigate some of those concerns and issues, during her tenure in office, your tenure, her policies exacerbated the situation. I mean, how do you respond to that?
I don't really see that in the numbers, because when you look at the numbers, there was actually a reduction during my tenure in African-American the prison sentences. It was a reduction that was somewhat significant. And I, like every other prosecutor, knows that we must change our system to do better. But I'd also like to point out that we also did a lot of good things with the community that I don't apologize for, that I'm proud of. And that is that when I got into that office, there were a number of gang murders of little kids, African-American kids, that had gone unprosecuted. And we took them on. One was a little boy named Byron Phillips, and he was murdered on the front steps of his porch. And that case had gone unsolved, actually. And I worked with the community, the African American, predominantly African American community, put up billboards and with the police. We found the killer and we prosecuted that case and put that guy behind bars. So during my time, we had many, many cases like that. And I made sure that we met the community's concerns. And I didn't just stay in my office. I went out there and met with them and worked with them. And we figured out ways to make sure that their neighborhoods were safer. And so the figure on the reduction in prison sentence was 12% during my time.
So I think one of the big concerns in a lot of communities right now is this opioid crisis. And I want to ask you a little bit about that. I know it's been at the forefront of your campaign, substance abuse, also mental health, which are sort of tied together. And I wonder if this is an area where you see a chance for some bipartisan compromise if you're president, because at least whenever there's a mass shooting, Republicans often are talking about mental health. And the president has certainly confronted or been talking a lot about the opioid crisis. Is this an area where you think you can get something done in Washington?
I do. And that's because you have seen glimmers of bipartisan work on this. The need is so huge. It doesn't matter if it's a blue state or a red state. One out of five people suffer from some kind of mental illness sometime in their life. That's a lot of Americans. One out of two have addiction in their family or someone they're close to, and that's alcohol or opioids. And we should not forget meth or cocaine, which tend to hit communities of color more than opioids. And so my solution is this. Let's just not talk about it. Let's put the money into it. And let's just not have it be only on opioids. My plan, $100 billion paid for by the master settlement we're going to see coming out of those lawsuits against the pharma companies that were producing the opioids, conservative estimate, $40 billion. And then more money from a 2 cents per milligram fee on the opioids. And I get to $100 billion. What's the money used for? Well, first of all, mental health beds. We went from a state-based system to a community-based system for mental health. All good intentions, good reasons. But so many states don't have the beds. In Iowa right now, they only have 64 public mental health beds for the whole state. And so you see this in Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire as well. And then we are having a huge increase in suicides. 30% increase in suicides in America in 15-year period. Answer, more early intervention, more counselors in school, making sure that we're watching our military when they come home, and so we're keeping touch with them. You've got the bed issue on both the addiction and the mental health, and then, of course, you've got insurance coverage, mental health parity, something my mentor, Paul Wellstone, before he died in that plane crash, was his number one focus. We passed the bill, but we need to get it implemented, and I'd note that he worked with Ted Kennedy on this. We miss all the time in the Senate. And then Patrick Kennedy carried on the torch. So there's a big Massachusetts-Minnesota connection when it comes to this work in this mental health area.
Sure. And let me just ask one more while I've got you, Senator. I know your time is short, but a sort of related health care issue that goes with that is, as we would pay for these services in the future, would it be paid for under a Medicare for all style health care system, which is very popular within your party? You're not quite there yet. You said perhaps down the line.
I'm always open to looking at it. I want to get there sooner. I want to get to more coverage. So this is what I'd propose. I think people have the exact same goal, which is universal health care. And the way that I would get there is building on the Affordable Care Act. So the first thing you do is bring down the cost of premiums. I would start with cost-sharing reinsurance, something that has been working. Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire actually has a good bill on this, and do that immediately. Then a public option, something Barack Obama desperately wanted to do. And the way you do it is by making sure that you have a competitive option, a public option, and you can do it with Medicaid or you can do it with Medicare, but it bring the cost down because there's no middlemen insurance companies. And I think it's doable because people want to see some kind of option for them that costs less money. Then the big ticket item, since it's nearly 20% of health care, is pharmaceutical prices. Nothing has been done. Nothing was done in the Affordable Care Act, and nothing has been done since then to bring down the cost of pharmaceuticals. I am leading the bill, and I have been for a decade, to require Medicare to negotiate on behalf of America's 43 million seniors to bring down the drug prices. There is a ban on that negotiation. That would set a bar for the whole country when it comes to pharma. Stopping the horrendous practice where big pharma pays off generics to keep their products off the market. I know that these pharmaceutical companies are major American employers. I know there's a lot in Massachusetts that is an important part of the economy. But that doesn't mean that we can't get a more even playing field for consumers when it comes to pharmaceutical prices. That, mental health, making sure we keep a woman's right to choose strong, those would all be things that I would be focusing on when it comes to health care.
That's U.S. Senator from Minnesota and Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar. Senator, thanks for joining us from New Hampshire today.
Well, it's been great to be on. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, what does the merger of Raytheon and United Technologies mean for Massachusetts? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.